Republicans go after Obama-era regulations, and how to keep the Oscars interesting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, February 20th. Good to have you with us. The Republican Congress is pulling out an obscure law to start reversing regulations that were put into place by President Obama. It's called the Congressional Review Act, and it gives lawmakers the ability to kill new regulations as long as they act fast. Congress typically has a little more than 60 days from the time a rule is issued. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Up until this Congress, the Congressional Review Act was only used once. Now, with President Trump on their side, congressional Republicans have already used the CRA several times and likely will continue until the clock runs out. On the chopping block, potentially dozens of last-minute Obama administration regulations. Darren Baxt is a research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Most of the time, you don't have a situation where both houses of Congress and the presidency are held by the same party. But we have a situation where the kind of stars are aligned.
Already overturned, a rule restricting coal mining companies from dumping waste into streams. Another, a regulation to limit methane gas emissions by oil and gas companies. Josh Mantell of the Wilderness Society advocated against these repeals.
Well, it seems that the regulations that they have decided to choose are ones that are opposed by some kind of major corporation or special interest group.
Now, groups like Mantell's have little recourse, because once you invoke the CRA, you can't go back.
It is a very blunt tool, because agencies can't reissue rules that are substantially similar.
Sophie Miller is with George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center. That limit on issuing similar regulations means a rule can't be tweaked. It's just gone.
So if you want to completely get rid of these regulations, then it's probably to your advantage to use the CRA.
Which is why Trump and the GOP are acting quickly to use it while they can. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are other ways the administration and Congress are planning to go after regulations. Take environmental rules. The newly confirmed head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, will address EPA employees for the first time tomorrow. The Trump administration has made clear it wants to move quickly to dismantle some of the Obama administration's environmental regulations. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what Pruitt can do to help make that happen.
President Trump vowed during his campaign to get rid of the EPA in, quote, almost every form. Christy Whitman, who ran the agency from 2001 to 2003 under President George W. Bush, says that's easier said than done.
Some of the things they've been talking about dismantling are set in statute and law. You can't just ignore the law.
But you can rewrite laws, or you can decide not to defend challenges to regulation currently in the courts, like suits against the Clean Power Plan, which limits emissions at power plants, or those related to the Waters of the U.S. rule, which sets the EPA's jurisdiction on rivers and lakes. Jim Bradbury is an environmental lawyer in Texas. He says the administration will likely try to get Obama regulations peeled back.
But they're going to have to do that in an environment of the political view of the United States citizens who says, no, no, we like clean air and we like clean water.
Many current employees at the EPA came out publicly against the Pruitt appointment, but it'll be difficult for Pruitt to come in and immediately start firing people. Tom McGarity is a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
You can clean house at the top levels, and Administrator Pruitt will certainly do that.
By top levels, he means deputy administrators and those just below. But many of the employees at EPA are career civil servants with federal job protections. Even if you could get rid of all those employees, McGarity says it would be counterproductive.
If you want to do anything, you're going to need the people in the agency to be not opposed to everything you do.
And of course, President Trump can amend the agency's operations through executive orders, something he could do as early as this week. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've got a new member of the president's inner circle. Word this afternoon, President Trump has named Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. U.S. markets are closed today, but overseas, it's business as usual. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. If you go to Hollywood Boulevard here in Los Angeles right now and stand in front of the Dolby Theater, you'll see crews hard at work setting up for the Oscars. We're less than a week away from the broadcast. That'll be Sunday night. And it's a show that, if you take a look at the award shows that have preceded it this year, could have a hefty helping of politics. There's no red carpet rolled out yet, but Mike DeLuca is there getting ready. He's producing the Oscars this year with Jennifer Todd. Their team is camped out below the theater, which is where I met up with him.
We're in a dressing room in the Dolby Theater. These are kind of our temporary offices. So we've taken over the dressing rooms, and we'll be here kind of encamped until showtime.
Tell me what the producer of the Oscars does. What's that job look like?
The first thing you do is kind of pitch an overarching theme, or, you know, kind of a story you want to tell that's threaded through the show.
To the Academy, to the network,
to the Academy,
okay.
To the Academy, and then eventually, you know, you meet with the network, and you know they check in periodically. We started getting together in September and October, probably October. There's only so much you can do pre-nominations, but, you know, you start lining up your wish list of presenters, and then things really kick into high gear, you know, the day after the nominations are announced when you know what you're dealing with.
You're starting to conceive of this back in September, October. At that point, this country sort of thinks it knows where the election's going. All of a sudden, you have a surprise, and then you have these award shows sort of taking on a whole new tone and a whole new meaning. How has that sort of factored into this Oscars?
Well, you know, I think... We've tried to be completely a political-free zone in terms of conceptualizing the show. Like, Jen and I, we wanted the Oscars to be a break from, you know, the preceding 2 years where tensions seemed to be ratcheted up in the country. And we thought the Oscars are an island of, you know, focus for celebrating movies. Because we figured, you know, the winners would comment, you know, as they saw fit or not about anything that was topical. We didn't know at the time if anything was going to be in the air.
And so now that you've seen some of the other attention and these speeches have gotten at award shows leading up to yours, do you sort of reach out to the nominees and suggest anything to them about their tone?
We thought the most elegant thing to do and the most respectful thing to do, because I really do feel like that 45 seconds is their real estate. And they've worked their whole lives, you know, to that point. To get to this place where the excellence in their work has you know been rewarded. So I think if people feel moved to do something, you know, in the moment that's unscripted and is from the heart, you know, so be it. So we're kind of, you know, up for anything. We just, you know, want the show to be vibrant and not be canned and be really live.
Do you think Hollywood sort of from this point, how do you think it's going to deal with sort of the cultural shift in D.C.? Where do you think it's going to find itself?
To me, you know, and I consume a lot of news and a lot of pop culture, and I'm a kind of a political junkie. I think it's even bigger than politics. I think there's been an unease and an anxiety since the economic collapse in 2008,
right.
You know, and that's still rolling through a lot of people's lives. So, you know, I think people do want to escape when it's anxious times. I'm less up for, like, dark, dark movies about anti-heroes when things are making me nervous. I want to see myths that reassure my maybe misplaced sense of justice in the universe. I want to see good guys versus bad guys. And this is just my personal taste. But it's not fun to have angst in your real life and then go to the movies and be hit with it again.
What questions do you have about the industry? As you sort of look at the film industry, what do you sit around and think about?
I think about, you know, I would love for the studios to walk and chew gum at the same time. I always think of the spot the studios found themselves in at the end of the 60s, you know, when at the beginning of the 60s, when Sound of Music was made, everybody had to have a musical. So the studios made tons and tons of musicals. And by the end of the 70s, they had, you know, completely burned out on musicals. Nobody wanted to see another musical. And then that set the table for all the filmmakers of the 70s, because the studios we're like, we don't know what to do anymore.
So
let's just let this guy Coppola and this guy Scorsese and this, you know, later, you know, obviously Spielberg but Friedkin. And I think, you know, we're at a point now where things are a little homogenized.
There's
love
a lot of superhero movies.
I love me some superhero movies. Like, I still have my comic book collection from when I was a kid. But you have to have new stuff. I'm not sure the 15-year-old version of me today is turned on by the fourth version of how Batman got upset.
Right.
But as long as there's a, you know, you know, some investment in what might be next for the audience coming up, then I think everybody would be on safe ground.
So what are you going to do the day after?
I'm going to Disneyland.
Right. The lines are too long at Disneyland. What are you going to do?
I'm a masochist. I'm going to read every single review.
Really?
Yeah. And then I'm going to do a postmortem with Jen and everybody we worked with about the experience, thank everybody, and then go to dinner. And eat really good comfort food. With me, it's all pasta.
That was Mike DeLuca. He's one of the producers of this year's Oscars broadcast. One other interesting thing he told me, it's the producer's job to decide when to bring up the music if speeches go long. So now you know who to blame or to thank. Now to a subtle point about small words. Small words making a big difference in how we perceive the world. Take wage hike versus wage increase. Turns out those two phrases send a very different message. KQED's Sam Harnett has our story.
You might not even realize how often you hear reporters using the word hike when it comes to wages. It happens all the time.
Minimum wage will take its first hike in several increments.
Are there any risks in hiking the wage by this much?
It could be bad for business, especially if the hike is only here in Cleveland.
It's no surprise journalists have fallen in love with this convenient little four-letter word, says Catherine Connor Martin. She's the head of U.S. dictionaries for the Oxford English Dictionary, or OED.
Hike is like a typical journalist word because it makes its copy punchier, it helps you avoid redundancy, and it fits better in a headline.
Originally, the word had nothing to do with economics. Connor Martin says it emerged in early 19th century England as a verb for walking vigorously or laboriously.
But before long, it also came to be used transitively with an object to mean moving, pulling, or lifting something, like hiking up one's skirt.
The OED documents the first use of hike for price in 1904. A Topeka Capital reporter wrote that a local store hiked ice cream prices from 5 to 10 cents. Bad news for ice cream buyers. Connor Martin says today the most common usages are for things people don't like.
Price hike, tax hike, rate hike, pay hike, fare hike, fuel price hikes, wage hikes, tuition hikes, fee hikes.
When things hike, there's always the sense that they're being pulled up against their nature.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at the UC Berkeley School of Information. He says that's the problem. With hike, he says, there's always some outside force, something yanking up the skirt or trousers. In the case of minimum wages, hikes suggest that raising them is unnatural. And that is editorializing.
Increase is a neutral word. Things can increase for the better or for the worse. When you want to emphasize the positive effects of a raise or increase, you don't use hike.
By using hike, Nunberg says journalists are focusing attention on the force jerking wages up, not the worker who earned the increase.
You don't go into your boss's office and say, I've been working here 8 years, I feel I need a salary hike. That implies there's something unnatural about it.
Nunberg calls the word hike particularly pernicious because no one notices it. It blends into what he calls the linguistic wallpaper. Nunberg tells me that the next time I report on minimum wage, I should stick to the totally neutral increase and save hike for stories about trousers or vigorous walks. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Coming up,
if we had something that didn't require refrigeration or freezing, if we had something that wouldn't spill if it thawed and the container broke, those would all be great things.
Making breast milk cheaper for families that need it. But first, let's do the numbers.
Here in the U.S., the markets were closed for President's Day. In Asia, the Nikkei advanced just under a tenth a percent. European stocks were mixed. Germany's DAX rose 0.6%. France's CAC 40 dipped less than a tenth of 1%. In London, shares in the Anglo-Dutch consumer products firm Unilever cranked down 6.5%. That's after U.S. food giant Kraft Heinz decided to drop its bid for the firm. Here in the U.S., bond markets were closed for the holiday. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Walmart releases its quarterly earnings tomorrow. The world's largest brick-and-mortar retailer has been in a long-standing battle with another retail powerhouse, Amazon. Walmart recently lowered the minimum purchase required to get free two-day shipping to help it compete on the e-commerce side of things. But as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, it's got a lot of catching up to do.
Walmart's new free shipping deal isn't an attempt to copy anyone else's strategy. That's according to a company spokesperson. But even if it were, and even if Walmart offered a better deal than, say, Amazon, it might not matter. Jonah Berger teaches marketing at Wharton.
I think the problem is more psychology than technology.
Berger says, imagine a burger. If you're like many Americans, you are thinking McDonald's, which can make things harder for the Burger Kings and Wendy's of the world.
Same thing is going on here. Walmart may have great offerings, they may have great deals, they may have just as fast shipping, but if they're not top of mind, people may not purchase from them.
Hart Posen teaches management at the University of Wisconsin. He says there are a few more wrinkles to Walmart's trying to take on Amazon. First, Walmart is not set up to sell goods online quickly and easily the way Amazon is.
Walmart-style, million-square-foot warehouses work very poorly to do one-off, two-off, three mixed items in a box kind of delivery.
Next, Posen says Walmart is a traditional store, but Amazon?
Amazon is hardly even a retailer anymore. Half the goods Amazon sells, they don't own.
But Walmart does own Jet.com. With that multi-billion-dollar purchase last year, the brick-and-mortar retailer made a major investment in e-commerce. David Schick is with Consumer Edge Research.
What that means is if you've gone ahead and started to invest digitally, and obviously Walmart's doing that with Jet.com, then you're committed.
And Walmart does seem committed to a growing online presence. It says free two-day shipping is now a necessity for retailers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The Concorde's first commercial flight was more than 40 years ago. The jet could fly faster than the speed of sound. It could get from London to New York in under 4 hours. But it stopped flying in 2003 and hasn't been replaced. At least not yet. Now, several private firms are working on brand new supersonic designs. The BBC's business correspondent Theo Leggett reports.
Concorde really did look the part, from her needle nose to her swept back delta wings. She was purposeful and futuristic. But she was also very noisy, so she was never allowed to fly on many of the routes she was designed for. And she was very expensive to run, which is one of the reasons why the only place you can see a Concorde now is in a museum like this one at Brooklands in southern England.
All the best for your approach. It's been a pleasure to serve you over the last 30 years.
Concorde made her final farewell to air traffic control and touched down for the last time in 2003. The aircraft was retired, its reputation tarnished by a terrible accident outside Paris 3 years before, and its costs no longer justifiable in an age of budget travel. But some experts think supersonic flying could soon make a comeback.
If you could fly from New York to Los Angeles, do a day's work in Los Angeles and fly back to New York, business people would love that.
Captain Mike Bannister was the chief pilot of British Airways' Concorde fleet. Sitting with him in the rather cramped cockpit of Brooklands Museum's Concorde, surrounded by the intricate array of dials and controls that once formed his office, he told me why he thought flying faster than sound could become popular once again.
Technologies have moved on. This aeroplane was designed in the 50s and 60s, so it was designed 60 years ago. We're looking now at what we can do in the 21st century, and what we can do is far more sophisticated. So the aeroplanes could be more efficient and, crucially, more capable of flying and making real profits on any route around the world.
This is no fantasy.
A number of companies are currently working on supersonic projects. Among them is Nevada-based Aerion Corporation, which has designed a super-fast business jet. Another is Boom Technology, a firm from Colorado. It wants to build a 45-seat supersonic jetliner. It would be a lot smaller than Concorde, but according to Chief Executive Blake Scull, it would also be a lot more efficient.
Today, the aerodynamics, engines, and materials are much better than they were 50 years ago, and you can build a supersonic airplane that's significantly more fuel efficient, able to work on a lot more routes, achieve economies of scale, and therefore have tickets that are much more affordable for the traveling public.
Boom believes it can have its new plane in the air by 2020 and is convinced it can make money. But others are more cynical. Craig Hoyle is editor of the aerospace industry magazine Flight International.
You have a challenge of getting an engine that can take off slowly without making too much noise, but then being able to go supersonic. There's a technological challenge to package that in something that's going to work affordably.
So a revival of super-fast air travel can't be ruled out, but it certainly isn't inevitable either. The chances are, if it does make a comeback, you'll probably have to join the Air Force.
That was the BBC's Theo Leggett. For families who can't breastfeed their new babies, there is a way to buy breast milk. It's sold online and at nonprofit milk banks. But it can be expensive. Breast milk can cost a dollar an ounce or more. In part, that's because it's hard to keep it fresh. From KUT's The Texas Standard, Joy Diaz looks at one effort to reduce the cost.
Kimberly Spires donates breast milk to mothers and babies who need it. It's not always an easy thing to do when she's on the job as a captain in the National Guard.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to pump in Humvees.
Moms are moved to donate their breast milk for different reasons. For Spires, she's assisted in too many disasters and has seen other moms lose their entire milk supply. So she donates her surplus milk for free. Donated milk from moms like Spires is then shipped to banks like the Mother's Milk Bank at Austin in Austin, Texas.
So in this lab, the milk has been poured.
Kim Up the Grove leads the Mother's Milk Bank at Austin. She guides me through the process and tells me another reason breast milk is so expensive is that it has to be screened for the presence of drugs or diseases, pasteurized, and then stored in freezers.
If we had something that didn't require refrigeration or freezing, if we had something that wouldn't spill if it thawed and the container broke, those would all be great things.
Well, one food scientist is looking into that something. Blanca Aguilar Uscanga with the University of Guadalajara in Mexico says milk banks in Mexico came to her with the same concerns as those in the U.S.
They asked if there was a better technology, and I was like, certainly, we could dry the milk.
Meaning turn it into powder by spray drying it. Spray drying is a technique that removes excess water from liquid. Claire Hicks is an expert on spray drying at the University of Kentucky.
Spray dried products are all around us. Every time we eat a chip, a Pringles, whatever, the coating like the buttermilk coating or the cheese coating, that coating is produced in a spray dryer.
The process is fast. And according to an article published by the Journal of Food Science, spray drying can be up to 50 times cheaper than other techniques for removing liquid. But it's not being used for breast milk in the U.S. Mary Michael Kelly runs Himbana, the Human Milk Banking Association of North America. It's the group that sets the standards for 26 breast milk banks in the United States and Canada.
You know, it's an interesting concept for sure, but we just know what we do works.
And what works includes pasteurization to keep the supply safe. But Kelly and other breast milk advocates may soon be able to see whether the spray drying technique works too. Aguilar Uscanga is running a pilot project in Mexico. She's testing the process with a small group of hospitals in Guadalajara. I'm Joy Diaz for Marketplace.
This final note before we wrap things up today. You know, Michelin stars, perhaps the most prestigious award in the world of restaurants and foodies. Well, it turns out the 2017 list of Michelin-starred restaurants, as it appeared online, accidentally included an inexpensive neighborhood bistro in the middle of France. The kind of place where you can get a full lunch for $13 or so, with plastic covers on the table. The bistro has the same name as a much higher-end restaurant that actually earned the star. According to the New York Times, the small restaurant has been swarmed by reporters, but so far, the locals can still get a seat. U.S. markets were closed today for President's Day. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see y'all tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.